Welcome to the Faith Element Podcast for the June 21, 2020 session, focusing on Matthew chapter 10, verses 24 through 39. Lose your life. I'm David Cassidy.
I'm Nikki Hardiman.
I'm Bert Montgomery.
And I'm Daniel Glaze.
All right, so we're probably living in varied levels of pandemic life still. But either way, it's beautiful outside. And, you know, whether it's springtime or already made it to summer where you are, it's really beautiful and a wonderful time to be out in nature and enjoy creation. One of the ways that we have decided to enjoy both getting a little exercise, but also getting out and about is bicycling. And so last weekend, we had planned to buy Regina a new bicycle for her birthday, which was mid-March, but it was like right then when everything hit around the pandemic, and so everything shut down. So we hadn't even been able to get to a bike shop where they could sell a bike until now. And by the way, there's been a run on bicycles. I have my son-in-law works at a bike shop, and he's like, we can't keep them in stock. Yeah. But anyway, there's some beautiful trails around here. There's one called the Legacy Trail that goes between Lexington and Georgetown, Kentucky. Goes through the horse farm territory. It's just beautiful. So we like to ride that and get out. So I'm curious, do you bicycle? And if so, is it more road bike, mountain bike, beach bike? I don't know. What do you bicycle?
I enjoy bicycling. I'm not an avid bicycler, but I own a nice bike that I can ride around Atlanta, and I enjoy riding on the streets. It's a little bit exhilarating, especially because I do live in an area where people are not used to bikes, and so you have to really be on your toes, I guess, as you might say. But I will say, in Atlanta where I live, it is very hilly, and so biking is typically a very strenuous exercise here. So I've got to go find a trail if I want something that's a little easier. But yes, I love to ride bikes.
I have one, but I haven't ridden it in a long time.
Fair enough. You want to right now, though, don't you? You're ready to go.
I would, but I would get to the end of my driveway and then have to turn around. That would be a big trek for me. I am walking a lot more.
Good.
Going for daily walks for a few miles, but I couldn't do a bike right now.
Yeah, it's funny you said that, David, because we're enjoying biking together as a family. We all have them in. It's mainly roads around the neighborhood, but then we've got a beautiful park almost in our backyard that we have some trails. And there's a neat Capitol Trail that runs from Richmond to Williamsburg that we've done a little bit of that. But it's difficult moving your bikes to somewhere to start riding. That's the difficult piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Well, however you enjoy some activity outside in these days, I hope you find a way. And for me, being in creation is peaceful, and it reminds me that while sometimes the world feels chaotic, that the creation of God is a peaceful and regenerative thing that we participate in. And when we are connected to the land, I think we are happier and more at peace than we are when we feel disconnected. So ride those bikes. All right. Well, we are in Matthew, and Daniel, would you help us get started with this conversation?
Sure. And I'm glad you started us off with that, which makes it, you know, you feel peaceful, because I'm going to change the subject on you.
Okay.
But let me first by, stating that, you almost can't watch TV today without escaping them. And I mean commercials for prescription drugs. Sometimes they don't even tell you what ailment the drug is intended to treat, but it doesn't matter. You need to ask your doctor if you need it anyway. And these commercials are soothing. The voiceover announcer is speaking of all the relief and healing and the great benefits of the drug. I've noticed that these commercials often show an active older couple playing tennis, taking a walk, or maybe, as you said, David, riding bikes. There's one, though, that takes the cake, and I don't see it much anymore, but Bert, Nikki, and David, do y'all remember the one a while back with the husband and wife sitting in bathtubs on the back porch.
Yes. Yes.
No.
You can look it up later.
All right.
Suffice it to say, it disturbed me.
Yes.
It sounds disturbing.
It is. But just when you think, start thinking, man, this is great. This is the latest, greatest wonder drug. I need this in my life. Then reality sets in. That's when the narrator begins to speak very quickly and recite the fine print. All the terrible consequences, though rare, they assure us, that could happen to you if you take this drug. One commercial I saw not too long ago was for an acne medicine. And I looked this up today. It actually said it can cause, quote, vomiting, headache, fast heart rate, bruising, fever, chills, body ache, purple spots, aggression, joint pain, and bone fracture, end quote.
Oh, just give me the acne.
Exactly. But the one that takes the cake is a weight loss drug called Ally. This drug comes actually with the recommendation, and I'm not making this up, that until you get used to its effect on your gastrointestinal system, you should wear dark pants in public. Lord have mercy. Now, believe me, I'm grateful for medical advances. I really am. But medications have risks. Everything in life has risks. Taking a new job, falling in love, it all comes with a risk. That's why it's important to know those risks, to know what you're getting into. Maybe that's what Jesus is talking about. Today's scripture passage comes from what some scholars call Matthew's second discourse. Matthew contains five such discourses, with the first being Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. We're studying part of the second discourse this week, where Matthew includes Jesus' words of mission or sending for the disciples. And forgive me, but Jesus' words here, well, it's not exactly how you might entice someone to come and follow. We've been taught, of course, that you catch more flies with honey than vinegar, but Jesus is pouring on the vinegar. He's reading the finest of that fine print. By the way, Jesus says, don't think I've come to bring peace. I've come to bring a sword. And I've come to set a man against his father, daughter against her mother, daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Whoever does not take up the cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Those who find their life will lose it. Only those who lose their life for my sake will find it. I've never seen that cross-stitched on a pillow, by the way. Jesus loves us too much to lie to us. He loves us too much to sugarcoat the risks of discipleship. I think he makes discipleship difficult because he wants our undivided loyalty. He wants us to give ourselves to him in such a way that there is nothing left over. A year or two ago, I was speaking with a good friend of mine. After a successful career in insurance, she felt within her heart that God had called her to preach. She knew she needed to obey. So she told her husband. He promptly left her. Following Jesus means being willing to give up everything you hold dear. Following Jesus means you must be willing to die. But here's the good news. The glorious paradox of the gospel is if we are willing to die, we will truly live. Following Christ is risky. It might cause you to march in a demonstration or get arrested protesting injustice. Following Christ might bring you face to face with people who are different from you, people whose daily existence is unlike anything you've ever faced. Following Christ calls us to know the risk, to know what truly matters, and to give our lives to it. That's a little background on our text for today.
Daniel, thanks for getting us into this passage. I love the small print warning metaphor that you use. That's perfect. And it does feel that way, right? Like it feels like what Jesus mm-hmm. is giving his disciples right now are, hey, make sure you know what you're getting into if you're going to do this. It's a long passage that we have for today, but I think really I found myself focusing on those last four or five verses as I was working with it. And I love that line. Jesus says, "You think I came to bring peace, but instead I'm bringing a sword." And I remember somebody pointed out to me one time that there is a difference between peacekeepers and peacemakers. Mm-hmm. And peacekeepers do anything that they can to keep the peace, to keep things steady, to keep from arguing, to avoid conflict. But peacemakers are people who are willing to do the hard work of getting to a place where all people are at peace. And sometimes that does mean that we find ourselves in tumultuous times. Mm-hmm. And so it helps me to think about Jesus in that way, because we know that part of what Jesus' mission was to bring peace to us, like shalom. It is a biblical principle. It is something that we understand. It's a way that he's the Prince of Peace. And so we know that's a part of it. But I think this passage helps give us a picture into sometimes in order to get to peace, we have to go through a period of no peace.
Yeah, that reminds me of something we've talked about before, that peace is not the absence of conflict, but sometimes engaging in that necessary conflict to get where we need to go, which is wholeness, healing.
Right. Right. And peace that goes deep and wide, not peace that is just on the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was watching the memorial service for George Floyd, and Reverend Al Sharpton preached the sermon. Mm-hmm. And he had a moment in there when he talked about everybody talks about how much they want peace right now. But you notice there are those who are working for peace and those who would just rather you be quiet. Mm-hmm. And for them, just be quiet. And that gives people peace. Well, that's not peace, you know?
Right.
That idea,
right.
And that's what you're talking about. And that reminded me of the documentary on Clarence Jordan called Briars in the Cotton Patch, the Koinonia Farm story. And you can get this DVD. And they're interviewing, or they actually have recordings. At some point, the white supremacist folks had threatened everybody in town, if you support this interracial farm, we'll come after you. And some store in the middle of town on Main Street was caught giving fertilizer or some type of equipment or something, sneaking resources to Koinonia Farms. So the building blew up in the middle of town. And then so all the good townspeople get together and call Clarence Jordan, the founder of Koinonia Farms, to meet with him. And they have all these recordings, and it's in there, audio recordings. And they're saying, you know, we're good Christian people. And it's our understanding that Jesus wants us to live in peace. And it's and they're talking to Clarence Jordan, your experiment has done nothing but bring no peace, but bring destruction to our community. But it wasn't Clarence Jordan that was doing any of the destruction. It wasn't Koinonia Farms that was causing the lack of peace. It was the bullies in the Ku Klux Klan robes, right? But peace means quiet, everybody be happy, right? And if there is something, you're riling our people up and we don't want them to be disturbed, and then we'll all live in peace. But they're the ones committing the violence, and the store owners couldn't see that. You know, and then it jumps ahead 25 or 30 years, and you've got a couple of townspeople saying, well, I wish I had more courage. I wish I had known to stand up. But we just didn't want our people to be too upset and cause more damage. And you see that, and I'm thinking we're living in that kind of moment right now, where good Christian folks, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. talks a lot about the Christian moderate, the white moderate. Everybody feel good, just keep the peace. And he says, that's the worst thing you could do, because Jesus is telling us to do justice. And that's going to disrupt people's peace, right? This is an important text for the moment in history that we're living in, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty powerful one. And I love that you pointed out that in the documentary you were watching that there were some townspeople today who, you know, say, I wish I'd had more courage. And in every movement in history, there are always those people whose years later wish they had done things differently. And I think that this passage even speaks to that. Just above the part we're talking about right now, so in the middle part of our passage today, beginning around 26, Jesus is talking to these disciples as he's preparing to send them out and telling them, don't be afraid. And he particularly tells them, don't be afraid of those people who can hurt you, like physically hurt your body. He says, do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. And he's basically saying, don't fear other people, but rather fear God. Because when you choose to fear God, and in that biblical sense, right, which is about awe and worship and kind of giving ourselves over to God's way, when we do that, then it satisfies that, or it dampens that fear of humans that we have, because we begin to live into this understanding that no matter what others say about us, we can trust that God loves us, that we are God's beloved, that we are God's people. So much so that even God knows all the hairs on our head. So I think that Jesus understands that his disciples are walking into a mission that is going to necessarily create conflict where they go. This is going to happen. He knows this is going to happen. And so he's telling them, hey, this is going to happen. Don't be afraid. Continue on with it. Fidelity to God is what you're aiming for and what you're calling others to.
And it's because the message of the gospel, the good news, it disrupts the status quo.
Right.
We can't be good disciples unless we are willing to work for the kind of valuing of other people that God has. So do not be afraid in verse 31. You are of more value than many sparrows. I mean, value for persons and creation is written all through the scriptures, but there's no statement of value greater than the fact that God would sacrifice God's son for us, for these people,
right.
For all these people. And so for us to act in ways that honor others, that expect people to be treated decently, paid decently, cared for, have quality of life, not be attacked and beaten, and have opportunity for life. You stand up against the status quo, and that's trouble. I think that's what you're saying, right?
Right,
Nikki?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Jesus, the way of Jesus calls us to disrupt the systems in which we live and exist.
Yes.
Because those systems care more about their systems than they do about the humans that access them. Mm-hmm. And that's the nature of, there's a part of this that is the nature of institutions and processes. Once institutions are built, once processes get in place, they do everything that they can to maintain themselves. Church bodies do everything they can to maintain themselves. You know, schools do everything they can to keep them going, because we think, right, that the overall purpose of the institution is greater. But there is something about what Jesus calls us to that says, even in maintaining those institutions and those systems that you have, you cannot devalue other human beings in that process.
Exactly.
And so if what you're doing to maintain institutions hurts humans, then it's not in line with what Jesus has called us to. And so I think absolutely, it doesn't matter what time we live in, if we choose to follow the way of Jesus, we are going to run into conflict with the systems and institutions and ways of being of our world. It is the nature of being a Christian disciple. We happen to be in a time in which a lot of us who are Christian disciples have had a lot of privilege. And now we're being asked to check that privilege and probably let some of it go. And so it feels more disruptive than normal. But the reality is, this has always been the call of Christ. And we've just managed to, some of us have managed to ignore it, that aspect of it, the aspect that puts us in conflict with those around us.
Yeah, yeah.
There's nothing comfortable about this passage.
It's not.
I mean, it's just...
So what I'm thinking here, and I'll just say it, I have no way to deal with it, but so, I mean, our churches struggle with conflict, right? I mean, yes. We all do. No, none of us like conflict, but
right.
But to, how in the world do our churches, which are among the most segregated times in our culture, our Sunday mornings, well, they used to be when we met, but how in the world do we begin to deal with the ways that our congregations have, do, could stop being part of the systems that devalue persons? How can we help? How can we name this issue without causing conflict? And maybe we have to cause conflict. I mean, who wants to do that?
Well, I think conflict will be a part of it. The question is, where is that conflict? So I think churches as a whole can choose to move forward together. And if they do so together, the conflict won't be internal, but they will come into conflict with bodies that they work with the way that processes happen in the cities that they live in the denominational organizations of which they are a part. If churches choose to take an act of lobbying or being activists as a part of their Christian faith and as a part of their community together, they're going to run into conflict when they go do that. And so I think conflict is a part of it, but I think we can have some control over where that conflict, maybe not control, that's not the right word, but it doesn't have to be internal for the church if they can all find their way to move together.
I think finding the way to move together, my experience over time has been inevitably that means having some conflict to get to that point and letting some people choose to leave. Mm. Not pushing people out, but letting them go. And some of the times the reason why churches will never progress is they're refusing to let people go. It's more important to keep them happy than to do what they believe is right. For example, when I was in high school, so this is in the 1980s, y'all, the 1980s, in the river parishes outside of New Orleans, our youth minister, who was a seminary student down there, began getting some children, local children from around the neighborhood, and bringing them to church. The problem was they were African-American children. This went on about 3 or 4 weeks. And we were starting to get to know them. I was in the youth group and stuff. And then they quit coming. And then 2 weeks passed, and then 3 weeks passed, and they were not coming again. And when we began asking questions, eventually I found out that a couple in the church went to the pastor and said, either those colored children, this is in the 1980s, either those colored children stopped coming to the church or we stopped coming. And they were the largest givers to the church. Mm. So the kids stopped coming. Well, are we willing to take the sacrifice? Are we willing to give up some luxuries? Are we willing to take a financial hit in our institution by saying this is the right thing to do and we'll bring these, let children come and whoever can come? Or are we going to stop and let these people stay because we want to keep the peace? But then there's no peace in the community, is there, if there's still that inequality? Mm-hmm. And a lot of churches have gone through this in recent years with LGBT equality. As we work through this, well, let's just all get on the same page. Well, if you're saying we've all got to get on the same page before we do anything, mm-hmm. inevitably there's going to be some people and power brokers and big givers who are not going to budge. And so if we're all going to be on the same page before we do anything, then we're just not going to do anything. Mm-hmm. And those who have made the transition have had to let people make threats and then leave on their own. They were not told to leave. They were not asked to leave. But let important people leave the church. And those churches have progressed and changed and become more inclusive. So I think getting to a point of action is going to involve internal conflict. until you find peace with who you are inside, internally, personally. You mentioned before, can you have peace without having going through conflict? And I think the same is true with churches. We've got to have some internal conflict and work through it to get to a point where we can act on the same page together.
What strikes me is, and I don't mean to water down this discussion by turning it sunshiny at all, but there is a redemptive quality to conflict.
Yes.
When we can do that in healthy and respectful ways. You know, ask any local church pastor and they'll tell you, one of the things that can be most damaging to church mission and fellowship and other things are those, is if you leave a meeting, the vote was unanimous, but then people hang around in the parking lot and talk about things and, you know, well, if only we had done it this way, or I didn't really agree with that, et cetera, et cetera. You know, those things can be so damaging. But on the other hand, if when we do meet together, someone brings an idea up and then someone else says, you know, I hear that, but let me tell you my struggle with that. And let me tell you some of my fears and worries there. Mm-hmm. Or have you thought about whether we might amend that to do this? And haven't we all been in one of those gatherings where you thought you knew what you thought, and then someone was courageous enough to offer an alternative viewpoint, and you said, you know what, she's right. I think there's validity to that. I think we were missing a key part of the picture here. That kind of stuff can be redemptive. If only we will have the courage to be true to the one who told us it was not going to be easy in the first place, I think we would be better off. And again, I'm not trying to water down, you know, the very difficult aspect of it, but conflict can be, it can be so redemptive. It doesn't have to mean we all, you know, go home in anger. It can be as simple as someone saying, you know, respectfully, I don't agree with that at all. And I don't think we should be talking about our neighbors that way. Or these are children of God, and here's the way I feel about it. I have seen that work in beautiful ways, and I hope we can do that today.
And it is a process, isn't it? It's a process that we're all part of. None of us have got this figured out. And I think the humility we bring to it, which is I hear you describing, Daniel, a humility that allows us to hear one another and to realize that none of us have all this figured out. But I think a part of that is the call for congregations to be organizations that learn, that we are constantly providing ways to learn more about the kinds of things that we think God cares about, right? And so, you know, we know that racial justice is an issue in our land. How we respond as congregations is going to vary from community to community. Each situation has its uniquenesses. Reading, studying, bringing in persons who can help us understand things we don't understand, learning history, all of those things can give us a way to talk about things that is intelligent and, as you say, Daniel, redemptive, right? Mm-hmm. And I think maybe in this moment, one of the things our congregations can do is plan to begin the journey. Plan to begin some way to open our eyes and our hearts and listen to each other and to our Black brothers and sisters who are suffering in this time. Listening is a really wonderful way to begin. Well, what a tough passage. Not peace, but a sword. That's hard. May we find ways to follow as disciples of Christ, but to do so in ways that are as redemptive as we can be, as we together figure this out. Thank you all for this good conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Subscribe to the Faith Element podcast on iTunes or Google Play. Learn more about our Faith Element Bible study curriculum at faithelement.net. Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.